child of poverty. So, hey, y'all, it's your girl Joy Has Questions. Again, another week, another amazing episode that I have in store for you all. I have one of my former coworkers, as well as his bomb-ass son, Gene Vernado, as well as Morgan coming on momentarily. But I am going to start off, as you know, with You Better Know. I was inspired to do this You Better Know simply because Gold Coast Orthodontics is blowing my phone up, and I cannot just keep running from adulthood anymore because I definitely told them I was going to pay for these braces. And needing a bag to fix my teeth is no fucking joke out here. Like, your girl is literally about to be on her Oliver Twist. Please, sir, I want some more, because these boys are expensive. So it made me want to do research just in terms of, like, who are some iconic African-American pioneers in the field of dentistry? And lo and behold, I found a woman by the name of Ida Gray. She later became known as Ida Gray Nelson. She was born March 4th, 1867. She was the first African-American woman to become a dentist in the U.S. of A. Mind you, she started off as an orphan, and then when she was working for the offices of Jonathan Taft. Now, just a little side note, Jonathan Taft is one of the founders of the American Dental Association, the ADA. I could not figure out if he was related to William Taft, who was the 27th president of the United States of America. Also, random fact, William Taft is the only president to work at the highest level for two branches of government. He was a former chief justice for the United States in the Supreme Court, and then he also was the 27th president. He's the only president to have that honor. And to be quite honest, I would have to do even more research to figure out how he was able to jump branches like that, because typically you are chief justice. That's the whole point of why you want to be a Supreme Court justice, because you get that position until you die. But needless to say, I couldn't figure out if Jonathan Taft was related to William Taft. But the point is, she was orphaned after her mother died as a teenager. Her father was a white man who never claimed her. I'm not going to assume that there was sexual assault involved in her conception, but there wasn't really much to share in terms of how she started off. So she was born in Clarksville, Tennessee, and basically she went to go live with her aunt Caroline Gray in Cincinnati. Now, she worked at a very early age, taking in sewing, and then she graduated from Gaines High School in 1887. So also, this is a young woman who's living during the time of Reconstruction. If I'm checking correctly, being born in 1867, slavery is just ending. On some Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry type shit. In terms of her schooling, that's when she started working for the offices of Jonathan Taft. Now, this was a man also who was an early advocate of women being trained as dentists. He had been the dean of the Ohio College of Dentistry, and then he also was recruited by the University of Michigan to help with their first dental school. So that's how he became one of the founders of the ADA. She worked with him for approximately 3 years, and then she learned enough just from being under his wing, his tutelage, to pass the entrance exams for the University of Michigan School of Dentistry. And when she graduated in June of 1890, she became the first African-American woman dentist in the U.S. She was widely publicized and celebrated for her efforts, and she opened up an office in Cincinnati. Now, come on, not only being the first African-American dentist, but then also having the opportunity to have her own practice. She serviced both white and black customers and was cited as a role model for other women. Now, she relocated her practice in 1895, and then just like she had done in Cincinnati, she serviced both black and white clientele, and she had a reputation for gentleness and for sincerity in terms of really caring about her clients, or I should say her patients. So also in regards to being a part of the dentist movement, she was involved in several clubs. She was the vice president of the Professional Women's Club of Chicago. She was the VP of the 8th Regiment Ladies Auxiliary, and she was a member of the Phyllis Wheatley Club, a group organized to maintain the only black women's center, or rather shelter, in Chicago. She died on May 3rd, 1953 in Chicago. And as a testament to her legacy, as well as to celebrate all of her efforts and things that she gave to the medical field, she has a diversity award that was established by the School of Dentistry at the University of Michigan. She definitely is a woman who against all odds. Like, there's no, like, being an orphan, not really knowing where your place is in this world, being also able to find an ally to actually really help her, not take advantage of her, and to have her own practice, that type of entrepreneurial spirit, as well as truly caring about your fellow man and wanting to help ease their pain. Let's be honest, no one wants to go. I am never thrilled to have my gum swollen, but I'm happy I'm preventing gingivitis. So I just would like to give a shout out to good Mama Ida Gray for all that she has given us. I know she is in heaven, perched, looking regal in all her Victorian glory, and I'm here for it. So now let's get started with Joy Has Questions. Okay, everybody. So it's your girl, Joy Has Questions, coming to you once again with another amazing episode. I am so excited because I have one of my fave people, former coworker from a long time ago in terms of the advertising world. I'm just going to leave it there. I'm like, we survived, we climbed that mountain, and woo, child, the ghetto. So we are over and done with that. But I used to always go to him for encouragement whenever I was just like, today is the day I'm standing on the desk and cursing everybody out. And him and his team would give me those good chili cashews or pistachios. I would just like raid their drawers. And then also it would just help me like get focused, because he'd be like, no, you are going to calm down. So I have my fave Gene Bernadotte here with his son, Morgan, who is, you all are just killing the game, I feel, in terms of like black boy joy, creative joy, having your own voice within the Chicago creative community. So I am honored to have you all here. Hey, guys.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yeah. He said it. Oh, I'm so excited. Like, we look so like alike, duh, genetics. No, okay.
That's what happens.
Exactly. So I'm just going to jump right into it. And I don't know if like the cosmos aligned. It was like, yes, we're going to give you all the toxic masculinity topics this week, because you have two black men who can at least shed some light on it. How familiar are you all with like the whole Cardi B Offset saga? That's just been.
I think we're marginally, like, I know that Cardi B.
Congratulations.
I mean, it's interesting because I'm too old to be knowing about this stuff, but I know about, you know, Cardi B was married to Offset, and then I don't know how long they were married. They just had a baby. It was like 5 weeks.
It was some time.
Was it some time?
And like, there's like a little like discrepancy, because like they proposed later than like. They like publicly proposed later than
after
like they
were
actually
married.
Proposed. Like, it was something. So like, we don't know. The record isn't clear.
Okay.
It's been playing out like an Atlanta telenovela. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just been like, what's happening this week? Mm. But yeah, so there has been multiple reports of infidelity. I'm not even going to get into like who the potential jump off side chicks. It doesn't even matter. Infidelity is infidelity. And so Cardi B announced that she was like, I'm going to divorce him. She's been remixing song lyrics at concerts saying like, we're going to get a divorce. Like, oh, she has been very vocal about no longer wanting this relationship. Mm-hmm. So over the weekend, she was the first female headliner for the Rolling Loud Festival. I don't know if that is an Atlanta-based festival where it takes place, but she's on stage doing her thing, and her soon-to-be ex-husband stops in the middle of her performance, walks out on stage with a cake and a mic saying, please take me back.
Oh, wow.
That's not your place. That's not the time.
He also... Now, this is...
Congratulations.
It's right. You played yourself. Now, also, on top of this, this is... Outside of the fact that he has been on Instagram, people have been clowning him. He's been on social media after she announced that she wanted to divorce him. He was like, you know, I miss Cardi, you know, adding her. Mm-hmm. Then there was one report of him, basically telling everyone, fuck y'all, I miss Cardi B.
It was a tweet, right?
Yeah,
I saw that. Yeah,
because we all know we're responsible for him cheating.
We should all know that
he
has
that
cheated.
That it's our fault.
And that he misses Cardi B.
Right, because we need to apply the pressure for her to go back to this situation.
We need to fix her problems.
Do you look at this as Oh, because I've seen so many like black white women people period that have been like, girl, take him back. And then it's other people that are just like this scream, raising my hand. Mm-hmm. That's like, this is scream, or this screams toxic masculinity. Mm-hmm. This screams complete utter selfishness based on your feelings, mm-hmm. not actually, you know, really getting to the depth or the root of what you caused or the hurt that you instilled. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to know, like, what's your take on that from both your perspectives? Dun, dun, dun.
So I think that, if just stepping back, I think that relationships in general are difficult, right? And so I think that part of the problem with relationships, if we can just take a couple steps back. Part of the problem, I think, with relationships nowadays, or, you know, the way young people look at them is they kind of look at them in terms of, you know, this short-term kind of thing. Like, oh, he's fine, she's fine, you know, I want to have sex or whatever. And beyond that, there is no real thought, right? And so one of the things that kind of struck me was when I was looking, I was watching, I don't know how I saw it, but Cardi B just kind of said, like, I guess we fell out of love. And I thought that that was interesting because love is not something that you necessarily jump into and jump out of or fall into or fall out of, in my opinion. I think that because people kind of have this infatuation, mm-hmm. way of looking at love, like, oh, he's sexy or whatever,
he popping,
yeah,
lip pop,
exactly, like, you know, something like that, instead of, to me, love takes effort and love takes work and love takes sacrifice. Mm-hmm. Right. And my son and I were talking about this and he was like, what do I know about love? He's like, I'm a teenager, I'm a kid, I don't know about love.
No.
Or it's like, look, I'm just trying to make sure that my locks are properly moisturized and my GPA is up.
So it's already a struggle.
Yeah. And so I think that because we don't have this longer term vision of what that means, you know, that means effort, that means sacrifice. And also it's something that's between two people. So I think that's why it's like difficult for me to comment on their relationship. And I don't, because that's one. And two, this whole thing, I think where they're going wrong is
public.
They're playing it out in public. Mm-hmm. And that's not where relationships play out, right? That's not where the work takes place. That's not where the sacrifice takes place. It takes place between, you know, you and that other person. And so that's why I kind of question the move in terms of, like, you know, going out on stage with a cake. Like, is he doing that for her?
For all I know, a gun could have been under that cake. Like, right. We all saw when Tina was trying to go out on stage and Ike popped up in the dressing room. I am not going to be sitting there oohing and aahing to some random ex just showing up on me.
And the thing is like, it's not about... I think that that kind of overture was more of play acting. It's like, mm-hmm. It wasn't authentic. If he was going to do something authentic and he really wanted to have her back, it would be a conversation between the two of them. It would not be on stage in front of thousands of people.
A bunch of high and drunk people screaming, do it, girl!
Right, exactly. Because like you said, to your point, what that seemed like was manipulation, mm-hmm. right? Trying to manipulate her into making a decision, or, you know, whether it's out on Twitter or whatever. I think that that's counterproductive, you know?
You actually, just to even highlight a point that you brought up, and no, I am not trying to compare this situation to Beyonce and Jay-Z. But one thing that I love even when I think about how their whole infidelity, you know, the separate albums and everything played out, when did he actually cheat on her?
I don't know.
I have no idea.
Exactly. Because even in his lyrics, he might make a statement of like how he had to get his best friend to like watch Blue while they like worked their, you know, personal issues out, or when he was explaining like, if me and my wife aren't good, no, I'm not showing up to your wedding. Like, right. That might give you a little bit maybe of a time frame, or it could have been something that reoccurred in terms of emotional strain and maybe she didn't forgive him, whatever. But you don't actually know when they were having issues in their relationship. Now, if the most photographed couple, or one of the most recognizable couples on this planet, can still maintain that level of privacy and, you know, separation between their public personas and their actual real life, it's not a matter of it can't be accomplished. It's a matter of what I feel people put too much stock in public opinion and not actually doing the work for their actual relationship. I think that was just something, you know, that you even highlighted a little.
Yeah, I mean, I think that even, you know, that's what relationships are. It's, you know, no matter how people perceive it, it is a relationship and an understanding between those two people. And I think that, you know, my wife and I were talking about it along with Morgan this morning, and what she brought up was the fact that that idea of sacrifice, like love requires sacrifice. It requires that, and sacrifice not meaning you're going to like gut yourself or anything, but it requires a giving of yourself, mm-hmm. putting somebody else forward, like no matter what form that takes, whether it's in a relationship with another person or a child, like we were talking about, you know, Morgan and my daughter, when you have kids,
a lot of sacrifice.
Yeah. Well, you put them mm-hmm. and their needs and their desires, you put them first, not out of like, you know, I'm doing this because you want to be a martyr or anything, but because you value them that much. They mean that much to you.
Right.
Right. And so their well-being means that much to you that, all right, I'm going to take the hit on this because their happiness
is more
is worth it. Right. Mm-hmm. And you know, one of the things that Jay-Z even talks about is like, if Beyonce's happy, I'm going to be happy. Right. And everybody knows, my son knows, like, if my wife is happy,
yeah,
the house is happy.
Say it with me, people. Happy wife, happy life. It's there true. Is a I level mean, of truth to
that's,
that.
There's some truth to that. But then also, like, she does things that, like, you know, she sacrifices as well, mm-hmm. you know, to make sure that I'm happy as well. You know, right. And you have to have both. It can't be one is sacrificing for the other because that's not sustainable, right? You know, if one end is doing all the sacrificing and loving and the other end is just taking,
that's gonna be a problem too.
That's gonna be a problem.
Morgan, how did you feel about it? Because I feel like you were just like, look, I just really want the music and I don't care about these shenanigans. Like, what were your thoughts on it?
I mean, I've been like, it's not like my head's been like under the like wool but I mean, like, it's definitely not been in my eye. Like, I saw Cardi's thing on like Instagram and I was like, oh cool, and I just sort of kept on swiping.
Because, like,
you know,
care.
It's like they're like, it's like, I mean, it sort of goes to like, it's their business, but also it's like, if they're trying to make it my business, like, I don't care. It's like, I'm chilling.
So, do you think, in terms of like, take a step back then? Yeah. Because I've also, you know, noticed with, I feel like almost more than before, or maybe even I think about my generation, like the Mumble or the SoundCloud rappers, like, now their girls have just as an equal, if not higher, you know, popularity or following. And I see a lot of my cousins, everyone is like, oh, what's Ari doing? What's Herbo doing? What's Jada doing with Lil Baby? What's, you know, all these, you know, younger couples. Do you actually look at them in a sense of like, oh, I want a chick like that, or I want a situation like that? Like, what's, or is it just like a continuous scroll of, look at these Negroes. I can't.
I mean, just like, I feel like my priorities are very like, it's like on a different list. Like, you know, like I'm trying to like, right now I'm sick. Like, I'm trying to not be sick. It's like, I feel like I keep on saying this all the time in the house, but I feel like I'm getting old. Like, I'm just like, my back hurts. Like, I don't get enough hours. It's just like my main priorities.
This
is just
ain't
like,
even top 20 for things that
yeah,
you care
it's
about.
Like I like
that's
I have I have like college apps. I have finals soon. It's just sort of like I could like, you know, I could like really like make it a part of my life, but like it would take a lot of effort, and I'm like tired.
You don't have the energy for
this,
it.
Yeah. Hold up. This is a young man that's like, all my life I had to fight.
Yeah.
I am not doing it this
I'm
weekend.
Just slavery,
okay.
Slavery. It's been a while.
And let me just also say, shout out to you just getting it through in terms of these college apps too, because that still was one of the most traumatic pieces in my life. Like, I had to simultaneously still study for all my, not normal classes, all the AP classes. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yes, like an idiot, let me take this junior and senior year. Like,
yeah, that's what he's doing.
The headache that it came with, because it was like, oh, you're writing from dawn until dusk. Like, mm-hmm. Because if you're either not doing it for that AP class, you're now doing it for future classes that are going to keep you up all night. But I like that, personally, your stance on it. Just because, I look at things, like I said, from the perspective of how does this connect the dots with, like, how we treat each other? Now, mm-hmm. you are an anomaly, because it's true. It's not, if I was to call any of my little cousins right now, I'd be like, yo, what's going on with any of these kids? They'd be like, girl, let me tell you. So this happened, and on this day she had on this jacket, but you see how he had on this in the highlight? And I'm just kind of like, what the hell are y'all talking about? And they will literally piece entire stories together, because they're so ingrained in a stranger or a celebrity's world. But that was just, something that when I looked at the situation with Cardi being Offset, I'm just like, just either go back to Love and Hip Hop or leave me alone. I don't care. Now moving though into still dealing with toxic masculinity or at this point, toxic femininity. Is that a thing? I think I'm going to coin that. That needs to be a thing, because there's a bunch of toxic black women out here too.
All right, we'll take that.
Nicolas Menagerie, a.k.a. Nicki Minaj, a.k.a. Nicolai the Great. She is in a new relationship that is completely, who cares? I'm just going to call him Alf. So she's in a relationship with Alf. And this is a man that has been in jail for manslaughter. Now, I am all about second, third, and fourth chances. So the fact that he was able to rehabilitate himself from that situation or time in his life and become a very well-respected music executive, go for what you know, sis. Slow hand clap. What is troubling, though, is that he is also associated with a rape case in which more things are being revealed that it was a kidnapping aspect of this case, holding people by gunpoint. At first, it was a situation of no one can really quite get the ages together. If he was 15 or the young lady was 16, there are other reports that he was 20 and the young lady at the time was 16. And people basically have been calling Nicki Minaj to task about how this is not an isolated incident of her being around people who have had not only just criminal past or issues, I should say, but specifically those of a sexual assault or child molestation assault nature. So just running through the Rolodex really quickly, she has paid funds for her brother's sexual molestation case. She did a song with Lisa Frank's son, Tekashi 6ix9ine, aka the coloring book. And now this situation. So when called to task on it, and specifically the Daily Mail called her to task, they were like, why do you continue to support rapists, like, or sexual predators? Her anger was taken out in the sense of like, oh, I'm suing y'all, that's defamation of character. And I'm just like, but it's truth though. Have you all, can you all listen to music like that? Or like, what is the line for taking a person's individual, story versus like what the media is saying? Cause I know plenty of people, like, I'm never going to stop watching The Cosby Show, but then simultaneously there's just something in me. I cannot listen to an R. Kelly song. So they're both sexual predators, but what's that line? Cause I will openly admit my hypocrisy. If I'm not listening to the Step in the Name of Love, and I shouldn't give a single gas or liquid fuck about the Cosby's on the stairwell wishing grandpa happy birthday.
Right.
I mean, I guess I've been thinking about that a lot. And with the Cosby's, I feel like the reason I'm still with the Cosby's is that the Cosby Show was way more than just Bill Cosby. There's a lot more people, a lot more hours, a lot more effort than just Bill Cosby. It's like the whole show is a summation of so many people, like the actors, the crew, the people who worked to make that show that show. It kind of sucks that Bill Cosby made himself the main figurehead and so much is tied with him, but I feel like that show is
a different world.
I feel like that show is still its own entity devoid of him. I feel like it sort of feels like, I like Bill Cosby, terrible person. I'm not about to buy any Kool-Aid, like any like,
not no even, more like, pudding pops,
like any like Eddie, like anything he tries to sell, I'm not buying into. But like still, like the Cosby Show is like a lot more people, but still at the same time is like.
Well, what about Nicki Minaj though in her situation? Because it seems like, you know, she's very defensive or making it trying to seem like, you know, it's society or people who don't even know the full story. But it's this man, I mean, even with Tekashi, he played like he's on probation after pleading guilty or no contest, which still is a light guilty to me. So
I think there may be a difference between the two of them in that what Nicki Minaj does and her influence on popular culture is limited, right? And what she does with her personal life, and I think that possibly she may have some issues that are bringing this about. Like, I don't know what her past was and what happened when she was growing up.
She did say she grew up in an abusive home.
So that may be a result. That may be how and why this is playing out the way it is. And I think that those things, the way that they manifest, are limited to her and her sphere, right? I think the reason that you may be conflicted and I myself am conflicted about Cosby is because that show was such a phenomenon and had such an impact on society and culture. And to Morgan's point, it went beyond just Cosby, right? It reframed how people saw black people. It reframed how we saw black fathers. It reframed what black people could achieve. It inspired an entire generation of black kids to go to college. And so the impact of that show goes beyond the personality of Cosby. And so now, what are we, 30 years? How long ago was Cosby on?
Last, it was like, what, 92?
Okay, 91. So like 20, 30 years hence. It's already had its impact in the culture. It's baked in. We've already had all these kids that saw Cosby like, I'm going to college. And now they went to college and they graduate. Now they've got careers. Now they got kids.
I'm not going to lie. Like, Mr. Gaines is the reason I wanted to go to college. If I could find, like, someone that was cool, like that man in the pit. That was like...
Right. Actually, he's from Chicago.
Stop it. Lou Myers was from Chicago?
He's from Chicago. I saw him at Marshall Field when it was still Marshall Fields.
Oh.
Down in the... I was eating lunch and I was like, oh, that's Mr. Gaines. Anyway.
Random facts, guys. No.
Yeah. So my point is that I think that the reason that there's a little bit of conflict is because you don't want to take it back. Like, in order for you to undo that, you'd have to be like, well, I'd have to command Z almost my entire life. Right. That got me here. All of the things that got me here were a part of that. You know, all the decisions that were made, all the TV shows you watched.
And you can't negate that type of influence.
And you can't undo that. Like, you take that pin out. Like, what happens? Where do you end up? Mm-hmm. Right. And so that's why I think it's difficult for people to sort of erase Cosby completely. Like, he did some. But there's Cosby, the individual who unfortunately did some horrible things,
right?
You know, and we all have feet of clay. His were more clay than I think others.
At this point, we working with Play-Doh. Like, what the hell were you going through, sir?
Right. And so I think I agree fully, and I'm not gonna lie, like when the accusations first came out, I was like, he didn't do it.
Wow. Right?
And then when it got up to 50, I was like, okay, well, 50 people can't all be saying the same thing.
I think the thing for me the reason why even I am just so ugh when it comes to Nicki Minaj, I don't care about her hypersexualism. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not bothered by that because I'm like, Josephine Baker was hypersexual. So if you, or you know, what is hypersexual or being hypersexual and also owning your autonomy? You know, like, I don't have a problem with if you choose to be modest or if you choose, you know, to be an exhibitionist. Go for it, you know, as a woman. Mm-hmm. I guess the issue that I have with her is it's always this sense of just lack of accountability
for
calling a spade no one is blaming you or trying to say anything. God forbid that we have or would have a situation in our own personal families where a trusted family member, whether it be immediate or extended, was doing something that heinous, right? Mm-hmm. That still is not me doing it. So it's like, even if somebody within your own household is doing that, I'm not blaming Nicki Minaj for the actions of her brother.
Yeah. Right.
You know, I'm not holding her on the cross with him. Because at the end of the day, this young woman has absolutely nothing to do with what this grown man or the actions, the sick actions that he decided. The issue that I have is, instead of being, you know, so argumentative, when people can just flat out see what you're doing.
Yeah, and I think that, and I think that that's the bigger, and I think that that gets to the larger issue. I think that when people start to defend and they're argumentative and they're, you know, their reasoning is based out of emotion and they're sort of like lashing out, right? When they're, when you bring up something, when you bring up something about somebody and they don't really have a reason for it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it brings in it, it kind of pokes at an insecurity, pokes at something that's raw for them. Then they're going to lash out emotionally.
That they haven't healed from.
That they haven't healed from. So she's going to come out fighting. Right.
Y'all ain't gonna tell me how to live my life. Y'all can't even control your own happiness.
Exactly. Because
sis, I just asked you if you wanted toast. Like, right.
Because you poked at something like back when she was little, she had toast and somebody mushed her in the face with toast. Right.
So now, anytime she sees a toast,
anytime she sees toast, it's like it's she's coming at you. Right. And so I think that the reason she's probably lashing out. I mean, I heard this from the. The prophet Jay-Z, and he didn't make this up, but hurt people, right?
Hurt people.
But he hurt people hurt, right? And he learned that after going through therapy. And I thought that that, you know, the interview he did, I forgot what the, was it with the New York Times or something like that. It was like a half an hour interview where he talked about the therapy he had gone through and how he had healed and, you know, he's still trying to heal. And one of the things he said was like, you know, hurt people hurt. And so when you are poking at something that's probably... emotionally raw for Nicki Minaj, she's not gonna rationally sit back and be like, oh, you might be right.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's because you've hit a sore spot.
And now it's amplified by the fact that she has, what, 100-something million people looking at her, you know, on her social media platforms in terms of what you gonna do, girl, how you gonna handle it.
Right. And then compound that with fame. Not that I'm famous or would know, but I've heard from people who are famous, like fame can put you in this situation where you're in a bubble, right? So you not only do you have 100 million followers and people are, you know, adoring you, you're in this bubble where people are telling you exactly what you want to hear because the reason they're telling you what you want to hear is because their livelihood depends on you being okay with whatever it is you're doing. So, you know, if I'm getting paid by you, I'm going to make sure that I assuage your ego.
Brooke, Riley, her two minions. I'm like, that's because you all need to make sure your paycheck for your filler stays like primo. Whatever the Blue Cross Blue Shield is that you have under her protection or safety net, you ain't going to tell her something to upset her.
Because my family depends on Nicki Minaj paying me or whatever.
It's ridiculous, honey. Right. They're tripping. It's not you. It's totally them.
Exactly. And so if you are surrounded by people telling you exactly what you want to hear, how do you get outside of that? I think that you have to make sure that you pick people in your that you surround yourself with who are going to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
Before you get
tell the emperor he ain't wearing no clothes.
Right, exactly.
I think to even highlight that point, so over the summer, me and my best friend, Amanda, I visited her in D.C., and then we did like a little cutesy road trip to Pittsburgh. And I remember we went to Frederick Douglass' home. We did a tour of his home.
What was that like?
I
love Frederick Douglass, by the way.
I mean, I got like, Frederick Douglass was raw. But like, you know, at the end where he like, you know, married that white lady.
Left his
yeah.
Wife.
So, yeah. So they definitely discussed that in the tour. Mm. how it wasn't a matter, I think it was, the way they explained it, it was definitely more like companionship based. The fact of how he did spend a lot of time with that specific abolition, like he married that what was his white friend abolitionist name? I can't remember at the time, but it was the daughter of his friend. So, I don't think it was him on his, you know, Emancipation Proclamation, OJ, like, let me get with this white woman, you know, because I can. I truly think that with him, it was a thing of, I know I am just as equal to everyone else, and this is who I've fallen in love with, which was, even at that time, I think was still, like, super revolutionary, because it's, his home literally is on a huge hill that overlooks D.C.
Wow.
Like, number one, the cross breeze up there, my God. Like, I literally could have just, like, walked out back and took a nap. Like, it was so peaceful, so beautiful. He actually died in his the home. So, they end the tour by, like, letting you know, like, he was getting ready to go to meet for some, like, some sort of debate that he was speaking at a church on the other side of D.C., and they were pulling the carriage around, and he just had a heart attack in the foyer of his home, and, like, he just passed, like, right there. And so, because it was Victorian times, like, they, you know, took him upstairs, and it was he had a funeral mass. That it was really great. But the point I wanted to bring up was, when they were going through the tour in different areas, because during that time, like, no one really had pictures. They would do, like, bust of everybody. He had a lot of times bust of some of his biggest, like, naysayers.
That's funny.
In the house. So Langston Hughes' great uncle was Frederick Douglass, like, biggest, like, issue. Everything Frederick said, Langston's granddaddy was like, nope, you're wrong, stop it, you know.
Incorrect.
John Hughes, they didn't see together, or not John Hughes, I'll check his name, but they didn't see eye to eye for anything. But the one thing was, Frederick kept him in his home, and other people that he had political disagreements with, and I thought that was beautiful, just in the sense of, like, what you were saying. You have to have people that just aren't going to necessarily give you a yes. Like, you may not like the person, or you may not, you know, agree with where they stand on certain subjects, but you still can respect them, and you still can also see, like, that might be a different view than mine, but I know you're coming from a good place and sincerity and wanting to help. And at the end of the day, I will still have you in my house and admire those qualities about you, even though you get on my fucking nerve.
Right.
You always are causing me issues.
Right. And it doesn't even, maybe it doesn't have to be that adversarial, as much as it does have to be, like, you know, somebody who's going to
check you.
And I think that not only do you need that in your life, somebody's going to keep you honest, right? Like, you need that in friends. You need that to surround you, not just people who are going to agree with you and tell you what you want to hear, but you need that in, I think, a mate, right? Somebody who's going to check you, somebody who's going to tell you, like, somebody who's going to love you, but because they love you, they're going to also tell you when you're wrong. And you have to be in a position like that, you love that person and respect them enough that you will, oh, really?
Okay, how ironic that Nicki made the lyric, I want to be the one to check you but still respect you. Ironic, but
truth coming.
Look, a broke clock is right twice a day. <That's> like, right. I'll give her that half place, a one. Right.
Yeah.
But no, that was just pretty much in terms of that. I think her argumentativeness and just her lack of accountability, I think it overall undermines, number one, her legacy, because now everyone just looks at her like, man, you really are out here needing the validation. You can't just evolve in your career gracefully, but then also it's just a matter of, like, you come off like a really rich person that has not been healed.
You had talked about this in your last podcast, kind of. When
with Domity.
Yeah, because you were talking about Kevin Hart, right? And you were talking about the fact that, you know, he had a birthday party for his kids, and it was Cowboys and Indians. And then when people were like, you know, that's not cool,
He doubled down.
Right. And he came out swinging. And instead of sort of taking a step back and, like, being like, oh, I hear what you're saying, that probably was not, you know, the best thing to be doing. Yeah. I have a theory, and I was thinking about it on the way in terms of why there is this collective consciousness that wasn't around maybe 20 years ago, 30 mm-hmm. years ago, or whatever. Like, so now we are more sensitized to the plight of Native Americans. We are more sensitized to the plight of women. We are more sensitized to the plight of Black people. And I think it has to do with the rise of the internet.
Definitely.
Because we're not just watching 2, 5, 7, and 9 and yeah. having those channels and those opinions beamed to us. Like, now
it's what are we scrolling and seeing on Facebook.
Everybody's got an opinion, and everybody's plight can be communicated all at once. And so, you know, if you're gay, you can communicate that. And I think that that helped move them forward. Mm-hmm. Native Americans, you know, their plight. I went to University of Illinois, which had the mascot. Mm-hmm. Was.
I hated that mascot.
Right. It was
dad,
the chief.
My dad couldn't stand him.
Right. Yeah. And I went there and we couldn't stand it. Right. But you couldn't tell that to a lot of people who were in power, who were like, I'm not trying to hear you. It's tradition, blah, 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 blah. Now, like, fast forward, it got removed, right?
Mm-hmm. I remember seeing white women in the stands at the last dance, like tears streaming down their face.
Jesus.
Right.
Because, like, I feel like part of that is, like, I guess they're losing this mascot that they love, but they're also losing a little bit of power. It's like, oh, I can't say what goes now. I have to sort of acquiesce to other people.
I think subconsciously that might be it. I think the delusion, though, in that moment was just like, oh, it's unfair that we're losing this tradition. I think a lot of times for the white power base, they live in that realm of what is acceptable in terms of tradition. Yeah. The Confederacy, this is our heritage. This is our tradition.
And tradition just means something you've been doing over and over again.
It doesn't mean it's right.
It doesn't mean it's right. Like, you could do something. I could be an asshole for 15 years and say, my tradition is I'm an asshole, but it doesn't change the fact that I'm an asshole.
And I personally have said this multiple times. I don't give a damn about your tradition or mm-hmm. heritage if it is rooted in the dehumanization or the disrespect of others. Like, if that's what your tradition is based in, and I suggest you get some new fucking traditions, because that's not acceptable. Like,
it's like the
just because it's a tradition, just because it's something you do over and over and over again, does not make it right. If you do something wrong once
and then you keep on doing it,
that does not make it that. That does. Because if that were the case, slavery would still exist, because that was the tradition. It was going on for 400 years.
Right.
Right. It's and like, if tradition made something correct, then that would be the law of the land. But it's not. If it's wrong, it's wrong. And I think that what happens now, and I think that what accelerates, you know, people becoming woke to these kinds of things
exactly.
is the fact that you've got the internet and you've got these things being able, these opinions being able to communicate. Yeah. I tell my kids, like, I say this all the time when they were little, and I still say it to them, is when they would have a question or want to know something, I'd say, you have a supercomputer in your pocket.
Yep. And then I stopped asking you things because you would lie to me anyway.
And before...
Before we dip, I was about to say something about, like, I've been thinking about, like, a lot about tradition and, like, how mm-hmm. white people sort of continue, like, justify things because tradition. I was saying, you know, the thing in the Netherlands with the Sinterklaas, the blackface.
I literally was about to, not only that, but that cake. The prime minister of the Netherlands got ripped a new one because, I keep going, I'll find it so I can talk about what you're saying, yeah.
And it's like, I was thinking, like, they do whatever they can to justify it, say it's tradition, say that they're showing Black people in a great light. It's like, it doesn't matter if you're, like, your tradition can't be me. It's like, it doesn't matter what your tradition is. It's still me, so I can, like, dictate what it does, like, if it's wrong, and your tradition is me, it has no basis. It's like, for the chief, it's like, your tradition isn't of you. It's from somebody else that you take. You're sort of reaching into somebody else's livelihood. You're dictating yourself off your control of others. And that's not, there's no basis. I feel like part of the reason why so many new voices are being heard is that we're adjusting what we view the center is. So much like institutions and so much like just like how we socialize things, like put whiteness or white people in the center and like everybody else should like, everything should evolve into whiteness or go into whiteness. And then now, maybe partially with the internet, it's just like things moving forward. We're realizing that, like, not even realizing, like, people who are marginalized are saying, like, hey, it's like, you're not the center and we're not the outskirts. Like, we matter as much in this. It's like, we're not going to cater to you what we believe matters. It's like, I guess with the internet, it's like the internet has like allowed that to happen. But like, a lot of it is just like people just sort of like reshifting the center. Mm-hmm. It's like, you're not at the center. You're not the sun. You're just a planet.
There is no center anymore.
Like, there's no center. You out here with us.
And I think that's also something that even I'm very vocal about with our own community. I do not believe that Black people can be racist, but I definitely believe that we can be prejudiced and bigoted. And that is, we have no ownership of the power structure. We're not the majority in terms of what we say goes in society, but we definitely can, I think, at times have this mindset of like, oh, our struggle, our fight, our this or that, and completely disregard the fight, the struggle, the pain, the dehumanization of others. Like, and I think Kevin Hart was just a great example of that.
Yeah.
Just because you are Black does not mean that you get to, you know,
you get to
disregard my community or my culture, especially when we just got through learning even more about Native or Indigenous People Day. I don't even call it Thanksgiving anymore. I mean, I understand that it was created by Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War.
Right.
But even outside of that, like, to celebrate Christopher Columbus,
he was probably one of the worst human beings, ever on the planet. Go ahead. What are you going
to
say?
I just wanted to bring up the cake. And this was something that I saw from 2012. So it was the Swedish the prime minister of like arts and culture. It was the racist cake controversy. So basically, female circumcision is something that at the time, I mean, it still is a issue in certain, cultures. But she was making light of it, making jokes, and like the cake was like this really almost like Sambo looking caricature of a Black woman, and then they made the joke like, oh, well, you're gonna cut the clitoris out the cake, and so the cake on the inside was like red, so it was just like everyone was like, is she nuts, like what the hell is going on here? And it even now makes me think about the controversy that's surrounding Prada, and how their whole Christmas line, the whole of it, but it was some like digital little toys, for Christmas gifts. And like, at first all I was seeing was the little dog. And I'm just like, this dog looks like the Pixar dog. Like, I am all for a conspiracy theory and I'm all about calling out bullshit. But I'm like, this does not look racist. And it took my friend sending me the actual figurine that was the conspiracy. And I was like, this looks like a pickaninny from a Popeye the Sailor cartoon from 1910. Like, what the hell is this?
Right.
And so I understood, like, Prada instantly hopped on it. It was like, oh, no, we're taking it down. We had no intention of being racist. But I'm like, the marketing or that ideology, it carries over. So your traditions have real repercussions in terms of embedding, or I should say, that's the word I'm looking for. Not reigniting. It's when you're solidifying.
Impacting.
Impacting, solidifying. Of course, I'm going to remember the word I meant at like 3 a.m. in the morning when it don't make no sense. But no, for reinforcing the stereotypes and issues that we have to face.
Right.
Totally not where we started with Nikki, but great, open forum. That's what it's all about.
Yeah.
And
I think, I forgot what I was going to say, but I think that, when the idea with Prada and putting out that little Black Sambo kind of thing and thinking of it as benign and not even thinking about it. And even, I know what I was going to say. I was going back to Kevin Hart and the idea of not sort of recognizing, the Native American struggle is, and then excusing it by saying like, oh, I'm Black, I have my own struggle. I think that as Black people, we can either go two ways. And I think our strength is that we have had this struggle and, in this country. And our strength should be in the fact that we have that struggle. We can empathize and we can see that struggle within other people. We should be the first ones
to
recognize it and see it and empathize with it and be like, no, we don't accept it for us. And we recognize it and we don't accept it in anybody else. Unfortunately, we also have the other aspect of it where we can say, well, because I've suffered,
Like, I don't have to care about you
suffering. I don't have to care about you suffering. I've had the exactly. most suffering. So
I'm not about to get into an argument over who had it worse, the Holocaust right. or the transatlantic slave trade.
It doesn't matter.
I'm not picking like apples and oranges out that conversation. You right. know, like, it and I've seen people that will literally mine is worse, back
and the point is not whose is worse. It's like
we've both been through it.
We've both been through
so
it.
So can we please come together?
Like we're both
exactly, exactly, and so. Instead of doubling down and saying, like, oh, didn't we all, you know, dress up as cowboys and Indians? Like, yes, no. that was before. No. Maybe, but that was before the internet. And that was before you had a supercomputer in your pocket. You have the opportunity, if you didn't recognize it, and let's say that he didn't recognize it before. Mm-hmm. When people brought it to his attention, that's his opportunity.
That's your aha moment.
That's your opportunity like, oh, to be wow. like, oh, I didn't think of that. That's one to grow on, right?
Or even just the stupidity of, like, even I find it hilarious, the whole thing of, like, oh, we all played cowboys as kids. But the thought process when you think about cowboys, you think of John Wayne. You think of, oh, Pilgrim, and he's saving the Wild West from, you know, the heathens that occupy the land. And the actual truth is that the typical American cowboy started off as African Americans because right. a lot of times the work was so dangerous and backbreaking, and literally you could kill yourself trying to mm-hmm. break these broncos. So it's like a lot of cowboys were black.
Right.
Same thing with jockeys. A lot of jockeys were black.
Right.
Up until a certain point in the Kentucky Derby, white people just bet on what the horse was, but they weren't going to get on them. But the thing was, once a lot of African Americans started winning so much, they were like, no, they've got to come out.
Yeah,
like,
right.
to bring them back, Johnny. We're not mm-hmm. doing this. So even with that narrative, you're still perpetuating a stereotype because you have no idea who you are or just like where you, what you come from in terms of your own community.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, I think that if we could bring that forward to Prada, I think that that mm-hmm. same blind spot exists. Right. Yeah. For a corporation like Prada, you know, they would probably like, oh, isn't this cute? Isn't this clever? You know, we're going to, you know, put out this product because we think it's so adorable. And that's the blind spot that happens.
It's a keychain.
Right. It's a keychain. And that's the blind spot that happens. You and I know this from where we were, you know, where we used to work. A lot of that happens.
Like Mariah Carey. I don't know her. Like, okay.
But a lot of that happens because you don't have a, because you have a one kind of thinking.
Yeah.
Right. The majority of people, I guarantee the majority of people at Prada were white and they all thought that this was great. And they didn't.
I always go to the director, the board of directors. Yeah. If you got that same sepia tone looking, because you, for the few people of color, you don't want us to really figure out, like, are they mm-hmm. black? Are they, you know, Indian, like, what is that? Is that a Latino ex member? Like, who is, yeah.
Right.
Nobody was us.
Nobody was there and nobody was going to pull your coat on. Like, I don't think that's a good idea. And so that happens. That happens with Prada. Mm-hmm. That happened with Pepsi. That happens with so many different. H&M happened with H&M.
People couldn't even tell me where the headquarters are. I'm like, so they're a Swedish based company.
A Swedish based, oh, of course. They don't know.
Everyone was white. Like, right. their suits were black. That was about it.
Right. And so you know that, you know, because they've got this one way of thinking, nobody's going to pull their coat until it ends in tears, right? Then they start to lose money.
Or they're no longer in the black.
Right, exactly.
Like,
right? They start to, you know, oh, it becomes a problem. And it always becomes a problem after the fact, right? Mm-hmm. It always, you know, after it becomes a PR disaster, after they lost tons of money. Then they want to, like, see yeah. what they
now
can
they
do
now they
want
to show us
it.
The plan. This is our 12-step integrate Negroes plan. We right. care now. Like, right. and they're going, like, shut up. Right. And even when I think about that, I see running through my timeline, all the Balenciagas on their right hand. Oh, you a basic, bitch. You still wearing Coach, and we leveled up. And I'm just sitting there, like, absolutely no clue.
Right.
No clue. Like, Tommy Hilfiger ain't the only one calling you nigga. Like, it's a lot of the rest of these brands that are completely okay with our consumption, but do not want us in these tables making decisions or you're to actually help give us equity.
Right.
More
so than the question becomes, like, and because I was thinking about this, the question becomes, we keep going through this cycle of action, reaction. Yeah. They do something stupid, we react to it. Mm-hmm. Then Somebody else does something stupid, we react to it. And so how do we release ourselves from this cycle? And it's probably the, you know, the idea that, you know, a lot of people like, you know, Jay-Z and Beyonce are, we got to start to build our own. I had this discussion with this really good friend of mine who was a director. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about the fact that he asked me, had I gone to the Museum of African American History in D.C.?
I was going to bring that up.
Yeah, I am in it. I should go.
I was going to bring that up. But carry on where you were, where your thought was.
He was talking about the fact that this museum is amazing because, first of all, it's the museum that has made the most money on the National Mall, right? I forgot how much it cost, but it made that up in like a month.
Could we pop out?
Right.
It's just a fact.
Right. Let me tell you, when I went out there, it was the biggest Black cookout. It was like standing in line, which took forever to even get in it because they were giving away free tickets.
Yeah.
You saw like Alpha memorabilia from 1955. Like you saw like old hit. They were in Sunday's best. You saw literally every possible different combination of Black person that you could ever think of, whether it was upper echelon to just like, you know, lower working class families, whoever, like to college friends together, whether you were, you know, Whitley Gilbert or Freddie Brooks. Like you saw everyone in this space.
And that's not only the point. And the director's name is Malik Syed, and he's an amazing director. He's worked with worked with Jay-Z. He's worked with everybody. This brother is phenomenal. But he was talking about the museum, and he said that the interesting thing about it is not only has it made the most money of any museum on the National Mall, air and space, like whatever, like it dwarfs them. Because it's not only making money from Black folks, but it's making money from white folks. And he said the reason why is because our history is the history of America. Mm-hmm. And he said, if you think about it, it's like music, it's jazz, it's blues, it's hip hop, it's R&B, it's everything.
It's even more than music.
It's more than culture. We have made the biggest impact on this. And he said, I'll never forget this. He said, there's something seductive about that. Like our story, the way that our story is, you know, sort of maps out the story of this country. There's something seductive. Like you can't.
Because you have to know, how are you still here? Yeah. White people may not ever just flat out say it. Or collectively have the true accountability for what their actions, you know, just how horrific or how horrible it was.
Right.
But let's be honest, when it goes for effort in every possible way, the powers that be have tried to keep our community out, to eradicate us.
Right.
Didn't do it with slavery.
But Black people still
did. Take everything away from us. Even when I think about soul food, yes, it's not the healthiest thing in the world. And yes, now we have options and access to, you know, to better food options, right? Holistically.
Mm-hmm.
But even when I think that is the story of Blackness, we make beauty out of, make diamonds out of dust. We make beauty out of darkness. Like,
we did it.
You cannot stop us.
You can't stop us, right?
You're still putting us several paces behind. If you level the playing field, I don't think the world would ever want to know what that looks like. Because if we're able to accomplish this without a level playing field, what happens if we do have the same opportunities now?
The fear of a Black planet. I mean, isn't that what?
True. Yeah.
And that's what the fear is. That's the fear. That's part of the fear is like, what if we were given the same, you know, opportunities? One, two, they're afraid that we'll do the same thing to them that they did to us.
Yeah.
Like that's the biggest fear is like, if we ever get in power and we ever take it back, like they're afraid. You know how, talking about infidelity, you know how like when people are cheating or whatever,
they project it
onto somebody else. Like they assume that what they're doing is what
they're doing,
what what the other person is doing.
And it's
right?
Like, actually, I was late because I had all these damn revisions. Like, no,
right, exactly. And so they're projecting what they're doing onto you. That's the same thing, right? They assume and they project what they have done and the way that they think about us. It's not even something that's in the past. Mm-hmm. It's not anything that's in the past. They know how they think about us. They know exactly how they think about us now. Mm-hmm. And it plays itself out in so many ways, like where they decide they want to live, where they want to send their kids to school. True. I mean, all of that stuff plays itself out now as much as people don't want to admit it to themselves, and they will contort themselves into pretzels to deny what they really think. And you know, nowadays, like, you call somebody a racist is worse than being a racist, right? Nobody wants to be called the R word now, right?
I don't want to be called fat, but if I'm fat, I'm fat. Like, you know, I don't, like, that's the thing, that we are so concerned with the perception, we're not actually getting to the root of the issue.
Right.
I also say this now, we are a culture that is offended over every little thing. Mm. I don't want to be around someone who is malicious, but I do not mind hurting someone's feelings to better them. And that's the thing. Let me back this up. It's not a matter of me trying to say something that hurts you, but I can't take away how you are going to feel or how you're going to react to my statement. I can even preface it by saying, I'm going to say this out of love, mm-hmm. because I support you. If you are someone that's morbidly obese, I just think, like, maybe we need to work out a little bit more or whatever, because your current lifestyle or your health choices are negatively impacting you, and I don't want to see you die. That can hurt your feelings. Now, I just said that in the nicest, most positive way I possibly could. Mm-hmm. But if it also still causes you to action, then I don't mind you looking at me in that construct of, like, in that moment, I hurt your feelings. Now, I'm also not going to come up to you and be like, look, that's why you can't fit your clothes. Sure. Or I hear you huffing and puffing like a clump. Now, I would never say that, because that's rude and malicious and not out of love.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But we get so concerned with, like, oh, are you offending this person, versus the fact, like, but is it the truth?
Yeah, we're concerned with how people are saying things rather than what they're saying.
Even more, if you're a racist, or if you're acting out on racism, you're offending me. You're like literally, like, you're jumping into my lane and telling me how to drive. It's like,
right.
If I tell you to get out of my lane, it's like, hey, you're
acting in, or you have to racism. Treat me with respect.
Yeah, and then they get offended as, like, people get offended the most from proclamations of self, especially, like, with white people. It's mm-hmm. like their identity is sort of, I'm about to say, like, a lot of their identity is, like, it's socialized, the belief that they have the right to dictate others' lives. It's, like, they have the right to dictate others. And it's, like, not just in, like, a big general sense, but even, like, in small things, in, like, small conversations. It's funny, like, a lot of times, like, if you're in, like, a conversation, like, especially in school, and there's, like, even if there's only one white person, or even it's, like, a bunch of white people, they always, like, the white people always make themselves, like, the center of the conversation, the authority, they choose what's valid or not.
Right.
And then when people say, it's like, hey, like, when people call them out on that or say, like, hey, you're directing my life, stop, get back in your lane, then they get offended because they believe their identity is control over you. So when you, like...
Or that should be the standard of the norm. Can't tell you how many times I have to say, like, my pride or celebrating myself is not me negating your pride of yourself.
It's like, you don't matter.
Right.
I'm chilling.
So if you get upset because I walk into, you know, work with a Black Excellence pin on,
mm-hmm.
me
ain't got nothing to do
declaring
with you.
My excellence is not saying that you are mediocre. Now, if you feel that way,
that's an issue. That's
you. That is an internal issue that has absolutely nothing to do with me. But me speaking life, like you said, Morgan, into myself, or being happy or positive about my own life, is not me saying screw white people. It's not me saying, and even the conversation I'm having, I know for a fact if certain people heard this, they couldn't think past the fact, well, not all white people are, I'm not like that. I have black, and I'm like, this is not me cursing out white people. This is not me saying I want y'all all in cages like DACA. This is not me saying that I'm secretly plotting the Nat Turner revolt.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I think about it this way, Barack Obama ran on the campaign of Si Se Puede, Yes We Can.
Mm-hmm.
The we was inclusive of everybody, no matter what your racial composition was, your ethnicity, socioeconomic background, sexuality, gender affiliation, any of that. It was we in terms of what, I don't want to say the illusion, but what the hope for what America stands for, mm-hmm. could actually be, right? What's the difference between that and All Lives Matter?
Now, there's an incredible difference.
No. In the sense, it's a difference in the sense of, and this has always been my opinion. It's been distorted and muddied up because it's always that reaction or that excuse that is used in the sense of, well, Black lives matter. Well, all lives matter.
Right.
But to me, if you were to strip away like the naysayers and the excuse that they use, to me, Si Se Puede, Yes We Can, and we all together, those to me still are equal statements that just have a different connotation based on who has taken it and run with it. And I think the thing is, if we are truly trying to get to that place of inclusivity, if we're trying to get to the place where everyone's life has equal value and equal voice within our society, that's what I mean by it. Not in the sense of saying like I support all, fuck that. No, yeah, I don't. Mm-hmm. Based on how it's been distorted and used.
I feel like.
But that's what I mean by that. You get,
yeah. Okay. I feel like Si Se Puede, like, Yes We Can, like, its basis is, like, that, like, mentality of, like, come as you are. It's, like, you don't have to change yourself in order to, like, you don't have to dilute yourself in order to get progress. Like, come as you are. And, like.
Because we will work together. Because
we will work together. We as, like, we is, like, a summation of individuals.
Mm-hmm.
For All Lives Matter is just, like, diluting everybody into this one big soup. Which is going to eventually just sort of cater to whiteness. It's sort of like with the All Lives Matter, part of it is just in reactionary to like sort of dilute Black Lives Matter.
Right.
But like All Lives Matter is just sort of just like All Lives Matter, but I don't want to address like every life. I just want to generalize everybody so it just make everybody one big clump.
So if the situations then that led to like those All Lives Matter statements, if that wasn't our mental association with it, would you feel the same way?
I mean, like, that's like saying like if the sky wasn't blue, then would you like the sky? It's like if it was different, then like, I guess, yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
But I think context matters, and I think that the difference is that Yes We Can was not a reaction to anything. It was a call. Yeah. It was a call. It was a call to arms like, yes, we can. We all can.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas All Lives Matter only makes sense within the context of Black Lives Matter. Yeah. Right. So All Lives Matter did not come in and of itself.
True.
It was so the context of it, because if it had come out first, it'd be like, okay. All lives matter. It wouldn't mean anything. It would not mean a thing. All lives matter. I'm like, okay. That's, I guess we can say that. But it would not have caught on. It would just have been gone away.
There'd be a difference. Like, it was like...
But but the fact that it came in within the context of Black Lives Matter as a reaction to that, it was like, no. And it was a way of negating it and saying like, no, it's not that Black Lives Matter. It's that all lives matter. It was an effort to trump it. And it's obviously false, right? Because if all lives matter, we wouldn't need to say Black Lives Matter, right? So, right. But that's not a truism, right? But one of the things that Morgan said that I wanted to sort of touch on is that whiteness sort of defining itself as the center, becoming problematic. We were watching Crazy Rich Asians.
Mm-hmm. I want to see that.
Yeah.
It's a good movie.
It's a good movie.
I like it.
It's a good movie. And the interesting thing about that movie was it was based on a book.
Right.
It was based on a book. And did you know that once Hollywood got the book, the suggestion was made, hey, wouldn't it be more interesting if we made the protagonist, the woman, white? Like, let's make her white. And it got shut down.
Are you insane?
Yeah.
Like, what?
Who told you?
But now, for us, it's like, have you lost your mind? And I'm sure for the writers and the people who are, have you lost your mind? Like, that's not the same story. Mm-hmm. However, if you are white and you're looking at this story, and they said the same. I don't know if you're old enough to remember Boomerang.
Yeah. Oh, with Eddie Murphy. Where are the white people in the movie?
Exactly. One of the things, they called it, I remember the time they called it a race movie because it was all black people. And there was no white people. And so people were like, where's the white people in this movie? And for them, the story is not valid unless there's a white protagonist, somebody that they can identify with and be like, oh, That's me in this story. The same thing with the Green Book, which I kind of refuse to see. Yeah. Or I definitely refuse to see.
The Green Book. Green Book. Yes, yeah. With Mahershala Ali.
And Viggo Mortensen.
Yes.
So that story itself, like it required from them a white protagonist. The Miles Davis movie.
So disturbed by that movie.
Right. They need the white protagonist because without that, there's a concern that it's not going to get box office draw. Like, who, you know, white people aren't going to go see this movie if there's no white people in it. And for white people, it's like, how do I find my way into this story if I don't see me? The question that I have is, ever since there have been movies, for the most part,
I've had to do that my whole life.
I had to do that my whole
and
life.
And I still saw Jurassic Park. And right I still here. Love Forrest Gump.
Breakfast
and
still
I'm
saw
not
Star
gonna
Wars.
Stop watching Fried Green Tomatoes right. or A Time to Kill or Men in Black or anything.
Men in Black exactly. had Will Smith.
So did Forrest Gump. It had Bubba Gump.
Yeah.
Damn.
But that wasn't your way in. That was not your way into that story.
True. The story was me watching this handy-abled young man yeah. and all these ridiculous lies of historical events that they right. put him in.
It's like even more. Right. It's like Breakfast Club. All white people.
Don't you forget about me. I was forgotten. There was nothing that looked
right.
like me.
Star Wars. Until, you know, the second or third one, till Billy yep. D. Williams got there.
I mean, we had the voice of James Earl Jones.
Right,
that's
right.
about it.
Darth Vader was black. I'm just saying.
he literally was.
Like Anakin, whitest boy I've ever met. But once he hit that lava, something changed. It's like when Professor X.
It was the juice.
It's like when Professor X hit the X chemical and then made the Powerpuff Girls. That lava was like the X chemical.
Exactly
that made
right.
Darth
me
Vader
some sauce,
black.
Because you've been out here in these galaxies.
The
just
Force was like, hey, yo, let me add some spice to you.
They hit the salt bay.
They just dropped it on him and then became Darth Vader.
And then he's like, oh, it's a new day. Oh, that was so enriching, especially how, like, well, I guess Nikki paved the way for a real conversation. So,
Yeah,
well, I do not know what you all will be drinking come cupping season 2019 that is currently upon us. But for those long, lonely winter nights where he lied and said he was coming over and he did not, make sure that you have Cavassier VSOP to ease the pain. It kept us posted in the summertime and it'll definitely be here for the wintertime with that smooth, velvety taste that we all love. So make sure whatever you are drinking that it is Cavassier VSOP. And now back to Joy Has Questions. But moving right into, so I have a question. I am, like I said, super happy to have you all here on the show just because of the creative aspect and how you all, I always think creativity is a form of protest. It is a form of activism because that's directly tied into your mind. And a free mind is a powerful one. Mm-hmm. So I found out about the Franklin Chronicles when I was at work.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I was just like, Danielle, what you mean? Gene out here got like a whole other, you know, branded life. Because, you know, there were a couple influencers at our old job. But it was just like, I just saw Gene. It's like, oh, okay. Creative director. Comes through in his blazers. Always going to like, that's it. So in terms of how you even got started with it, also, huge shout out to Howard Schultz just because I love peanuts.
Mm.
Like
Charles Schultz.
Oh shit! I said Howard Schultz.
Yeah, that's the CEO of
take that out. Take Starbucks. That out. Yes, I said the wrong white man. Yeah. I was like Charles Schultz, and I went to that Museum of Science and Industry when they had in like 2012. It was dedicated to him. I got to see his old typewriter.
Yeah. Oh wow.
They had like all the life. They had a whole section dedicated to Franklin, like when he you know got introduced.
Yeah.
So what made you start it?
So I started the Franklin Chronicles. Maybe about 18, 20 years ago when I first had kids, and I was a young father, and this was like, you know, the beginnings, like social media wasn't really around, but blogs were. And so I was a art director in advertising, and I was looking around at the stories that were being told, and I was like, I ain't in none of these stories. Like, my experience is not in any, like, it's not really being represented on television. You know, Cosby had come and gone. Television, movies, the commercials we were making weren't about me.
What?
And so I decided, like, oh, since there's this new thing called the internet and everybody, you know, democratization of, you know, everybody's voice, I was like, let me do mine. So I started writing my stories because and it wasn't anything more than I wanted them to exist somewhere in the universe. I just wanted it out there. And so I just started writing stories about being a father, stuff that I thought, you know, all of my crazy musings and nonsense. Yeah, a lot of it is crazy musings and nonsense. And so so that kind of like it started getting a bit of a following. And I never claimed to be a writer. Like I was not a writer. I'm a graphic designer.
Visually.
Yeah, so I'm an art director. So I was just writing what I thought. And so I got better and better, and people were following, like, hey, this is actually really good. Like, the stories were funny and, you know, all of that. And so the blog started evolving into a podcast. Like, podcasts came out in whatever, the early 90s. I was like, oh, let me try podcasts. Like, this seems cool. This was the first iteration. Like, now podcasts are, you know, way more popular.
Everywhere.
Yeah. And so I started telling my nonsense stories into a microphone. And then eventually I had a friend who I used to work with who saw the Franklin Chronicles and started reading and listening. He was like, hey, why don't we start shooting these? Like, we can make these into short films. So I was like, cool. So the Franklin Chronicles is basically my view on life and, you know, just a black father, you know, and his experience out in the universe. And just, you know, it's very idiosyncratic because it's very much my voice, which I had to sort of get comfortable with. The reason that it's called the Franklin Chronicles, if I could back up, is because when I grew up, you know, I was growing up in the 70s, mm-hmm. right? And so it's indicative of a time, right? People who grew up on the same things I grew up on, PBS, Sesame Street. Like, this is when Sesame Street first started, Mr. Rogers first started. Like, all of this experimentation in the 70s was happening, right, on television. And so you've got Peanuts, you've got Sesame Street, you've got the Electric Company, and you've got all of this stuff poured into this little black kid. And one of the things that I remember of Sesame Street was the character Roosevelt Franklin. And he was a little puppet, and they had this little theme, and they sort of had this little school thing where Roosevelt and his friends would learn, right? And so I noted that, and then also the Franklin character in, you know, Peanuts was mm-hmm. named Franklin. And so I used that name as like sort of like a call out to be like, this era of black kids is Franklin, is me. And what happens when Franklin gets old, right? What happens when Franklin, when this kid gets old and has kids of his own and grew up with this worldview and starts to impart it to his friends or his friends and his kids, and how does that look, right? Sometimes it makes sense. Sometimes it comes out in like nonsense. And like what my wife likes to say, a lot of times when my kids were growing up, I would, like Morgan kind of alluded to, like I would make shit up all the time. Like they'd ask me something and I'd make it up.
Yeah.
Some people call that lies, but I call it creative storytelling. My wife used to, you know, when I'm telling these stories, my wife used to walk in and be like, stop trying to make my kids stupid. So that's kind of like the genesis of the Franklin Chronicles. And, you know, it's just gone on from there. And now my whole goal is to like make it its own brand, right, and, you know, move it forward.
Alrighty. So in terms of Morgan Man being a child of, you know, Eugene, in essence, like, did you start to get your own like creative pulse by looking at your parents? Like, where did that come from?
Shout out to Taylor.
Yeah, shout out to Taylor. Big hey, shout out.
And also to your mom.
Like, and my mama. Yeah, and my mama. Like,
yeah, so what helped spark your creative passion? Because you're an amazing spoken word artist.
Oh, thank you. I mean, I have a lot of like different, I feel like, I mean, like when you like do poetry, you have to like think about your past a lot. Mm-hmm. I feel like poetry is like a, it like makes you do your own therapy, because so much of poetry is like based off like your own experiences, and then you just sort of like get caught up thinking about your own experiences and your past. So I'm like, I've been thinking about like what has inspired me and like what's brought me here, and a lot of it like was in part like my father just always being in the house. It was like my father was always writing something, like he'd be telling all these stories. Like I remember like just like seeing him, like, it's like when he'd be downstairs recording the podcast. Me and Taylor weren't allowed downstairs, like, we kids, and like, he's recording the podcast, he has to be efficient, and he was cousin. But, like, sort of like, just like,
now we grown, so we in here, no, here.
I'm in the podcast,
right?
But, like, just having this giant in the woods of like my father downstairs with the podcast, and sometimes hearing like some of the stories that he wrote, and then like, and like even like besides like the podcast, my father like is always just telling stories. Mm-hmm. Like I always say, like I come from like a family of storytellers. It's like
family of grits.
Like every time, like anytime you get my father, his brother, and like his father, my grandpa, in a room, they always finna tell a story. It's usually the same story over again, but like the intensity that they do it is like higher. And it starts with, like, my uncle with the story, and then my father joins in because my uncle messed up. And they both, like, really get into telling this one story about, like, how they didn't do the dishes as a child. Mm-hmm. And then, like, they do sound effects, and they do, like, oh, and then this happened, and this happened. And then my uncle has to do something in slow motion or something. And then my grandpa comes in, and he talks about, like, y'all didn't do them dishes. It's, like, that's sort of besides the point, but just sort of, like, like, we're always telling stories. We're always telling our past.
That
like,
was a pattern always, of what you saw.
Yeah. And, like, I always wanted to join in. I always wanted to be a part of that. And, like, I always wanted, like, to be a good storyteller. And that sort of, I feel like, went into poetry. Mm-hmm. My direct, like, thing that really, really got me into poetry was just my sister. Like, she was in the spoken word club before me. She's 2 years older. So she was, like, ingrained into my high school spoken word club before I came in. So, like, once I came into high school, she was, like, the main force that was, like, pushing me into poetry.
Okay.
So my sister was really the definite thing that, like, pushed me into poetry and, like, kept me into poetry and made me feel comfortable in the whole poetry community.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I had to shout out to her. Like, big shout outs, like, big props. She did a lot for me. Love you, sister.
Gotcha. So in terms of looking at your relationship, which I think is beautiful, I also... it's so ironic. I just had a conversation this weekend just in terms of, like, you know, sometimes strained relationships between, like, Black fathers and their children, mm-hmm. Black mothers and Black daughters, sometimes, like, how that's an unspoken thing. We don't talk about that trauma mm-hmm. in the sense of how Black women raise their daughters or treat their daughters mm-hmm. Or that pathology. But you all seem to have, like, a very... and this is totally on the outside looking in. I'm pretty sure there's some days you're like, oh, God, where's college? But, like, mm-hmm. you all seem to have, like, a pretty, you know, very healthy relationship. What would you all both attest or attribute to you all, like, seemingly appearing as not only father and son, but as friends?
I don't know if we're friends. We're still father and son.
He's okay. My pops.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
I mean, well,
because we have this thing. When my kids were young, you know how kids always are, mm-hmm. and they'll be like, they get mad, and they'll be like, you're not my friend. And me and my wife would always be like, that's right. I'm not your friend. I'm your father. And gotcha. I don't get it twisted. Like, because, you know, our thought is that being a parent is more than being a friend. Like, why would I downgrade myself to being right. his friend? Like, I'm his father. I'm, you know, we have a different relationship, right? But I think I would say we're cool. I think that yeah. part of the, I'm sure I get on his nerves because I always say somebody's strengths becomes their weakness, mm-hmm. right? So I'm the storyteller, but I'm also what I had to learn, you know, in raising a child. And if anything, it's probably, I have to give credit to my wife, but when I was raising Taylor and Morgan, I never, when I would discipline them, I didn't spank them or anything like that, but I would lecture the hell out of them, right?
Yep.
And they would, and their eyes would glaze over. And so it's like a different form of storytelling, right? It's like, now this is the bad part. It's like, oh, that's what you did? Okay, we're going to have a conversation about this, and I'm going to tell you about this for an hour and a half. And they would just both like, oh, God.
Oh, I'd rather get beat.
Right. I would learn more just in a quick spank. Right? Like, my mother had it right. It's just like, oh, you did that? Spank, spank. And then, like, whenever I might go up and do the, like, whenever I might do something wrong, my mother would just look at me, and then I remember that spanking, and then I stop.
Right. Like, no, I'm not going down that road. Right. Ever again.
So, yeah, we had different parenting ways of parenting. Like,
she
always
folded the laundry, did all things. She's like, are y'all still at this kitchen table?
And
like,
she'd have to pull my coat. She'd be like, you can't be lecturing 3-year-olds for an hour and a half. Like, that's not gonna work. Right. And so I had to, like, you know, change and sort of adapt or whatever. I always say, like, my anger is like thunder. It's like, you know, rolling, rolling. My wife's anger is like lightning. Like, when she gets mad, it's like, ka-chow! And it's, like, hard, it's fast, it's loud, and then it's over. Mm-hmm. Like, she'll come in the room, like, have you lost your mind? And I didn't curse. She would curse. I remember one time, we were in the living room, and they were, like, 7 and 5 or something. And I was talking to them. I was like, who curses in the house? Is it me or your mother? And they're both like, mommy. And my mother, my wife was walking through with laundry. She was like, that's right. I curse. Don't get cursed at. But yeah, so she had a different way of just like coming down. But she's also fair. She's also very fair. Right. So, you know, you don't want that lightning coming down in your head. But, you know, that's it. It's over. I still love you, yeah. And they move on. Me,
talk and talk,
and I'm gonna be mad for a month, right? So
that's how to balance it. But I think though it's you all haven't said that, but the talk, it's the communication. Mm. I think that's something that whether or not you are a household that looks at your kids and go, like, there will be that line of demarcation. I'm your mom, I'm your dad, I'm not your friend. Now, I can only speak, you know how we were talking about trauma or, like, from earlier situations. That was something that was always said to me. I don't know no black child that, or a child period that hasn't had that. I ain't one of your little friends out here.
Right.
But I know for me personally, that was something that always, like, hurt my feelings because I was just, like, I wanted to get to a place of, like, where I could feel like, yes, now as a child, I know I'm not your friend. Mm-hmm. But once I get older into adulthood, I do want to be able to have, like, yes, I'm never going to kiki with my mom or, you know, with my father like I would one of my girlfriends. I'm right. never going to be like, girl, let me tell you. No. Like, that's just not
But that does evolve. The relationship does evolve. Right. And so when they're young, it's more of you're instilling. It's like you're
the
filling their cup.
Yeah, the moral code.
You're trying to fill them up with everything that they need. And basically, I think teenage years is the final, is the exam.
Yeah.
Right. All this time you've been studying and you've been trying to, like, right? You've been trying to fill them up with everything that they need to know.
Morgan
and then
over here happens, like, another complete final. Breakdown. He's like, can you just not use that word? No, like, find a synonym, a test, something.
An exam.
Right. But now is when they the interesting part is, you know, when everything you try to teach them is when they start to apply it.
Exactly.
Right. And so now they apply that to their lives and, you know, they're picking and choosing all the things that you have said and you're like, oh, don't choose that. Or, but they, you know, it's up to them. Like a lot of it is, and that's going to carry them forward. But the other cool thing about it is you get to have a conversation with somebody and see how their mind works. Right. Mm-hmm. Like when they get older and they're not children anymore, they're young adults and they're making their own decision and forming their own opinions, and you get to sit there and be like, what do you think about that? Mm-hmm. Right. And you get to hear that back and like, oh, that's really interesting. Mm-hmm. That's cool.
I think also it's creating an environment where your child has the freedom to know, like, my response may not be something that would be your response. Mm-hmm. But it still is a baseline or a threshold of respect. Not, yeah, let me just keep this to myself or placate you and give you an answer I think you want to hear because I'll be condemned if I tell my truth or like how I really feel about the situation. Right. So I think there's still an openness there, though.
I think it's something that you said at the beginning of your show where you said that you are trying to get people to think critically. Yeah. Right. And I think that that's one of the things. And I even heard Michelle Obama say that that's one of the things that was instilled in her in her childhood. Right.
Michelle Obama, the best of us.
The best. She is the best of us.
She's so sophisticated. I love her.
Right. But that's one of the things that was instilled in her was, you know, being able to assess and think critically. And I think that that's what we try and instill in our kids as well is, you know, looking at the world and trying to inform them of the world, but then giving them a sense of like how to process that and think about it critically. Mm-hmm. So
I feel like part of it, it's like you're talking about like how like other parents is like, and other kids, like they have to hide what they're saying or else they'll mm-hmm. be like criticized or else they'll be like, what is it called?
Like judged.
Not even judged. When like emperor just sort of like lays the hammer down and just like,
you said that and I thought a totalitarian. I'm like, yes, that's exactly
something
what
like that. It's like, you have to like, it's like your opinions and your viewpoints, you have to hide it in order to like
to survive.
Yeah. In order to just be more palatable for your parents. And it's just like, I guess in like my household, it's like, you know, I got opinions and I got like viewpoints. And then my parents are just like, all right, what are your opinions? What are your viewpoints? I feel like now I have this relationship where like I can like, my father can ask me, what do you think about that? And like, he won't immediately like devalue or like devalidate what I said. Mm-hmm. It's like, he won't smack it down. He'd be like, oh, that means nothing. You too young. It don't matter. It's like, I feel like my parents have raised me in a way that like they raised me in a way that was like, I'm sorry, I'm fumbling my words.
You're fine.
They raised me a way to have like a basis for whatever I believe or whatever mm-hmm. I'm thinking. So when they like ask me a question and I give my opinion, even if it's different from their opinion, they raised me in a way to like have basis for my opinion. So they mm-hmm. know that it's like, it has legs. Yeah.
Like, I think that's something that, it's very rare to find that, and I definitely thank your parents because it's a skill that so many don't have. You know, even the best family situation still has its own trials and tribulations. You know, that I'm pretty sure like you all have those.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
I think though, at the same time, to have that ability to look at the world and to not only on the outside like live and let live for everything else, but or to have respect for everything else, but then to also be able to form your own thought separate of it, to me it's the ultimate. I'm standing on stage and I'll say, might be out here with this little raggedy ass ice cream cake and I don't care because my thought, my opinion is this. I think it's the ultimate form of freedom, you know.
I was like, we were like yesterday we watched Crazy Rich Asians. I'm bringing that back again. It's like, not to spoil it, but like the mother is very like
traditional,
like demanding of the son, like has like definitely knows what she wants the son to do, and they're in like a old money rich family, so it's like you have to like marry rich, you have to do all this stuff. It's like
this
so
is
much
for the betterment of our.
I know what's good for you, and this is what's good for you. So do what I say, and it's like I feel like a lot of that is like based off like it's toxic and like it's just based off projection. It's like you don't view the kid as their own entity; you view them as like a projection of what you want them to be. And like, and that's in itself, that's like dehumanizing, mm-hmm. and that's just not a good way to like function. And that's not going to raise a good kid that's going to go out and do great things on their own. It's like, you always want to treat their kid like, you always want to treat your kid like, well, I mean, I don't know anything. I don't have no kids. I mean, like, at least for me, I want to be treated like I'm my own entity and like, I like can make my own decisions. And even if your kid's like young or a toddler, they can't be making decisions, but like the things that they do like decide for themselves, like the small things, at least respect them and let them have that.
Yeah. I mean, but do you think that, I mean, I think that there is that, but then there's like the balance between that and being too laissez-faire of like, just,
right.
You know, and I think that we, as they have gotten older, you know, my daughter's 20, my son's 18. And as they've gotten older, we give them more latitude because that's part of being grown is being able to make your own decisions, and good, bad, or indifferent, making your own decisions. We try and guide them, you know, when they're 3, you want to guide them tighter.
Yeah.
When they're 18 and 20, you give them more latitude. And I think that one of the things that me and my wife talk about is like, we kind of give them a wide berth because we trust them, mm-hmm. you know, to make good decisions. And we give them a wide berth and say like, okay, what are you going to do? And then
I
every
know Vanessa Huxtables in this household.
Right. Like, Vanessa, you wanted to have big fun.
Look,
you wanted
to have the slight big sidebar. She historically was a sneaky ass child, always doing right. something. Like when she had the boyfriend that Rudy was lying for, that was a whole situation when she was wearing makeup. Vanessa was never just like, she thought she was older than what she was.
Right. Yeah.
And so she was always making like the worst decisions out of everybody.
Right. Right.
Like, you're an idiot.
Right. And yeah, so what we try to do is like help them make good decisions when they're young and mm-hmm. kind of like, you know, root them in that. But then as they get older, you give them latitude. And every now and then, and I don't think we do it too much, but every now and then we'll be like, yeah, you're not doing that. Right. And every now and then we'll, and then it's always a discussion and they'll look. And then my wife will say, we rarely tell you no. So when we do say no, we mean it. There's reason. Like, there's a reason. And what do you say? Yeah, you're right.
Mm, no. I mean, like, there's some things. There's some things. It's like what I said, like, when I asked my mama, like, it's like, hey, I want to get my ears pierced. And she was like, no. And I was just like, why not?
She didn't say no. She said no. She said not right now.
She is saving face now. She's like doing
all right.
A little,
so this
a little
is the
back.
Section of the podcast where we are going to let these
the
family
tea.
Issues work out.
Yeah.
Like, no,
I'm
okay.
just yeah. I'm gonna
like,
just, I'm
leave no, that. No, that's the disclaimer. The thoughts and feelings represented by the Bernardo family are not that of Joy Collette Weathers and the LLC. I'm all kidding.
But that's like the own thing devoid of that. But I mean, like. Like there's
I
things.
Thought that was actually going to well, it is epic for you, but I thought that was going to be way heavier. And I was like, oh, okay. Like, we can discuss that. I got you.
I mean, it's like the whole, like, Jay-Z, Beyonce, like, Cardi B Offset. It's like, that's just us. Like, if I'm about to have a conversation with it, you know, then I'm just finna do it.
Well, can I ask you, why do you want your ears pierced?
Because I want my ears pierced. It's nice, you know? It's something.
It's a fashion thing.
It's not like a fashion thing. It's just something I want of myself. I want my ears pierced. I want to wear earrings. It's something that I... It's something, like... It's like why people's like, why do people get tattoos? It's why do people like to wear certain clothes? It's like, I just...
No, I get it. Because I have 10 tattoos. It. But I also, like... I find, even with you being 18 and your daughter being 20, it's still... Even, I'm thinking back to that time... It really was a transition. There were things that my parents told me no at that technically
I could have just done myself.
No, right, but it's still a respect because there's a difference in, you know, now me being 29 versus 19, right? I remember the one time I got into the worst trouble of my life. I rolled up in the house at like 3 a.m. and I was 19 when I did it. Like, if she'd have called the cops, they'd have been like, well, she's legal, ma'am. She's an adult. We can't do anything about this. But I still, I got grounded because it was winter break from school. I got grounded and couldn't go anywhere. But it was like, I respected that even though, the law might say this, but I ain't trying to be on the other side of this door either.
It's not my house.
Exactly. So it was still like the respect of those rules even when you have like, the technicality on your side. Like, no, that's your parents are looking at you like, you ain't that grown. Like, you know?
And then the other side of that is like, this is what my wife always says, like, when they say like, I want to be grown, and she's like, okay.
Right.
My wife always, okay, good. You want to be grown? Good. That means less for me. You can have these bills, you can have all of it. And they're like, no. I don't want to be grown. Like, no, you
something.
Don't.
Many a day I have thought about the foolishness of my decisions with having a Verizon wireless bill. Like, and then you got to add ComEd and social media management and CTA and rent and everything. Like, it's never ending.
It's already too much for me.
I still, to this day, I hear my parents or my mom's voice sometimes in my head like, you want to be grown so bad? You have the rest of your life to be grown. She's like, you are a child for a little while.
Right. I was thinking about this the other day. I was thinking, like, we spend your youth trying to be grown.
And trying to get back.
And you spend your adulthood trying to reclaim your childhood.
Yeah.
Right?
or you, the freeness that you the, felt or in that like, time.
Yeah, because yeah. you remember how, because you've got all of the weight of all of this responsibility, and that takes up a lot of your decision making and life. Mm-hmm. When you were a kid, you were just playing.
Running through sprinklers.
Right. And you,
catching grasshoppers.
And that feeling of freedom, like you said, you trying to capture that, like, oh man, I'm 51. How can I recapture that of
zest?
Yeah. You know. So like you said, you're gonna have a long time to be grown. Sure. You got a short time to be a young adult or a child.
And I mean, in the grand scheme of things, like, it's another bill. Because let me tell you something. My accessories are out of control. So, but I think just, you know, wrapping up and talking to you all, where do, you know, even creatively you see yourself going? I know, like, you've been pouring all of your zest into the Franklin Chronicles. And then the same question for you, Morgan. Like, with you, it's just around the river, but like you are going to be out of high school, going to college. Where are you like looking to go? Like where does those goals for you as well?
I guess for me, my number one college choice is Brown. I just finished up my college app for Brown and then I sent in all my stuff. I guess my future one, most definitely going to college, but also like I want to like, I guess, end of the year, I want to get better at poetry. I want to like hone my craft. I want to eventually like write some form of book, either that be poetry book or just actual novel. Like I want to I want to like, you know, like a lot of times, like my father talked about all the time, like I'm just sitting down, just looking at open space. My parents are like, what you doing? I'm just like, what am I about to do with my life? Cause I'm just like, what am I doing? I need to like, I need to produce something. So I want to like, you know, do something. I'm like a lot of time I'm filling out college apps and a lot of the questions are like asking like, oh, what do you want to do at this college? What do you want to do with this major? And then like half of it's like, oh no, I have to write this new essay about this question. But other half is like, oh, what am I trying to do at this college? What am I trying to do with this major? Mm-hmm. And it makes me like sort of like put that in perspective and really be like, oh, well, I guess I'm passionate about this and I really want to do this. So I guess like one thing that like I've realized a lot lately is I'm really passionate about just like the general Black experience. It's like I'm just talking about like there's like I love it's like I talk about all the time. Slavery was a terrible institution, but like the lives and like the experiences of like slaves like are so like vital and like they were the human experience and like they are an important part of history. And I really want to like go in depth into that. And, like, really study, like, pull a little Zora Neale and, like, just do, like, this slave anthropology of just Blackness from, like, Middle Passage all the way now and just see how that's
That would be epic. Have you ever read The Warmth of Other Suns by Isabel Wilkerson?
Nope.
Okay, so we're not I don't fan out over anybody. Like, number one, I've worked in advertising. I've always been around, like, celebrities or, like, higher ups. So that don't mean nothing to me. That was the one time where, like, if she'd have touched me, she touched me. So Isabel Wilkerson wrote The Warmth of Other Suns. It is it's the most concise, yet simultaneously interesting and entertaining, I should say, compilation of, like, from the Great Migration. And that's a specific time because what you're talking about, that to me is an anthology of books. Like you out here trying to write the next Roots and go for it. You know, like that's possible. Do it. But she wrote the book based on the Great Migration, and she did it from the perspective of three individual African Americans who left from three different areas of the South, moved to three different areas of the North in three different decades. Because I
that's
think
so raw. I'm sorry. That's so cool.
It was number one. Not only did she do that, but while she's personally weaving in what is going on, like actual, you're hearing Ida May talk and, you know, George Schoolboy Starling and Robert. And as you're reading these, you know, their actual stories and what's happening to them, like at different years or points in their life, you're also getting this depth of knowledge of what was happening, like what caused the Great Migration in terms of you know, just the lie or the assumption that, oh, the Great Migration happened during World War One, and it was just this, like, but no, it started, people, the Southern blacks had always been kind of migrating, but the boom started then, but it didn't end until, like, the 50s,
right,
you know, and then even she went into the details of, like, how that migration even affected the white counterparts. Like, if you don't, it totally made the South finally mechanized. If I don't have people to collect all this damn cotton and all these crops, I'd better get up on the technology and figure out how to mass do it myself. Mm-hmm. You know, it was amazing. And they're now trying to turn it into a movie. I'm just, or a series. I'm like, I need to figure out this production schedule. Like, I've got to be there.
Yeah, I'll be on it. Hopefully they don't green book it.
We'll talk after. We're like, what is wrong with green book? Okay, but yeah, that's something that in terms of, even when it comes to the research, it took her 10 years to write that book. Now, it was a New York bestseller. She is very wealthy now because of that book. Has a movie deal because of it. But still, like, just to even go over, like, the process, it's something that is not easy, you know, but it's definitely not too daunting. There's people doing it all the time. Becoming Michelle Obama, she sold 1.4 million copies in a week. But it's a book about her entire life. So it took her a lifetime to get to, you know, to have that experience to want to share. But it's definitely possible. So you got this.
Yeah.
Just get past some college education. Don't Red Bull too much. Because I'm like, it's god-awful beverage. I haven't reached there yet. Okay, good. Fine. In terms of Eugene, like, with being a father, being a husband, you all are even coming into a new stage just because it's like, man, your kids are grown. Like,
right.
It's about to be like,
you old, dang.
She's like, I deserve it. I have earned it. Yeah. So what's, like, going on with, or what are you looking forward to creatively?
So creatively, like, I don't think my mission has changed from that first spark that I had with the Frank Chronicles. It's probably increased. Like, I want to manifest this in the world. I really am, you know, since I've departed, you know, my last career, this is my new career, is, like, the Frank Chronicles. Like, I want to make this, you know, put this into the universe as, you know, planted as deeply as I possibly can and see how far it can take me. You know, I want to continue. And the interesting thing is like, now, you know, when I first did the podcast, it was a thing. And now, you know, I'm rethinking, you know, how we're going to reboot the podcast, and it's evolved. It's, you know, my concept of what that is going to be has evolved, right? It's going to include my son, who does spoken word.
You finally can go downstairs.
Right. Yeah. Like, I'm part of it now. So, I have a seat at the table.
Right. So as that evolves, like, that story is going to evolve, and how it comes to life is going to evolve. And, you know, I just want to, you know, push that into the dirt as much as I possibly can. So between, you know, doing that with Frank Chronicles and the podcast, and, you know, we do live events and readings and all of that, I'm just going to try and see how far I can go. And then as far as being empty nesters, like, we're looking forward. Like, somebody was just asking that. Somebody just asked us that and was like, what are you going to do? Like, your son is leaving. Y'all are going to be empty nesters. And my wife's like, we going to kick it. Like, what you think? Like, we going to kick it.
Can I also just say this, y'all? Like, whenever I have seen Gene and his wife out, like, just two people that outside of, like, just clearly, obviously, the romantic aspect, their husband and wife, but just two people that actually fuck with each other. Like, you can tell, like, this is my nigga. Like, I love her and I love him, and we enjoy each other's time. Like, that's something that's very refreshing to see, especially in our generation. That's totally based on, do we look cute as a couple? Do we have the slow song playing? Is my hair blowing in the wind? But do we like each other? You know, like,
I think that's key to everything. I think that that's probably the key to a lot of my relationships. Like, I really enjoy being with my wife. Like, she is.
Do you hear that, black men?
Well, I mean, like, I'm not trying to sell out us all. But no. I really enjoy being with my wife. She is. I just sent her a text the other day, and I'm not trying to get brownie points, but I sent her a text like, she is one of my favorite people. She is so smart.
She should be your favorite person, the number one.
Yeah, she is my favorite person.
Yeah, so. Who are you, baby? Like, who's above mom, dad? Like,
yeah, I mean, I really enjoy being with her. Like, she, you know, I go to her for counsel, for wisdom. Am I doing this right? No, you might want to rethink that. Okay. Yeah, you know, and she, you know, brings balance to my life. Because, and I'm not going to lie, like, when I was in, you know, I've told stories on the Frank Chronicles about my life in terms of, like, pre-Latricia and post-Latricia and, like,
PL.
PL. There's PL and AL. But, like, I was a asshole. Like, I, for a long, and the good thing about it is, like, she saw all of it. And she was like, yeah, no, you were an asshole. And that's why I wasn't messing with you. Like, there was, we could not be together. And then, you know, things evolved. And now I look at her and, like I said, she's like, she's my greatest counsel. There's the, there's that idea of, there's the saying that says, like, marriage is a fortress of well-being, right? It's a fortress of well-being. And I truly believe that, like, if you find the right person, like, in, and it's not just like, it's something that you cultivate as well. Right. And so, but home is the place that I go where it's like, oh, I can let everything go. And I talk to my wife and, you know, we talk about all just about everything. Right. I could talk about my day and tell her, like, let me tell you what the hell happened in this nonsense. Mm-hmm. You know, I could take off the mask. Right. You know, when you go to work, when you go to work and you're in the corporate, you're, we, what is it? Claude McKay. We wear the mask.
Mask on.
Right. Mask on.
And you
right?
get the coffee. Good morning.
Right.
And you, great.
Right. Right. And all the time there's that double consciousness of, like, the you and then the you watching you. Right. Mm-hmm. And when you come home, the fortress of well-being is like, oh, I could take all of that off. And let me tell you what these fools did. Let me tell you what they said. Or the advice. And like, oh, I'm thinking of saying or thinking of doing this. And she's like, oh, you might want to think about it this way. And, you know, it goes both ways. Like, oh, you might want to think about these things. But that is our, like, our fortress of well-being. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so, yeah, I really enjoy her. So yeah, we're gonna kick it.
He's like, so we kicked. Doing all the mom, dad, can I come? No, you can't. No. We actually got a spades event going on tonight, so go to one of your cousin's house or a friend. Yeah. We'll see you tomorrow. Like, what? Like, I can totally see it just being a thing of y'all, like, having fun. I mean, clearly you all have been having fun as a family, but, like, having fun.
Yeah.
With each other and really, like, trusting that your children are out there being productive young adults, you know, you ain't got to, you know, worry about them.
And to carry on that, and I don't want to belabor this, but the other thing that I truly love is I truly love being around my children. Like, I truly, I like, it's not a chore for me to be around them because they're.
You don't feel bullied like Future.
Mm. No. Yeah. I feel like just being around them is like, they're funny. And just and they're witty, and you hear, like, you just sit back and you hear their conversations. And a lot of times, like, me and wife will just, like, sit back and listen to them and just look at each other and be like, man, that's interesting. That's cool. Or, you know, there's this when they were young, they would be in the back seat of the car and they would say something stupid and they would both crack up. They would just, like, they would say, oh, look, the lollipop in the floor. And they would think that was the funniest thing ever. And they would just crack up and they would point out stupid things. And me and my wife would just lick each other and be like, them's baby jokes. Like, them's just, like, it's something that's between them that we don't get. But now, just, like, watching them, like, them and their baby jokes and watching them interact. And it's like, you get a joy from that. Like,
right.
Like, yeah, that's cool. I like it. Yeah.
That's beautiful. No, like, all jokes aside, that's something that's really beautiful. I intentionally, because, you know, I'm, like, wrapping up the year, and I'm like, ooh, what type of different combos for shows can I get? To see a seemingly healthy, happy Black family, that's an amazing thing. So or an aspect of it, because it was just the guys here today. I didn't get to, you know, see the girl side of the family hold second it down. Half. I got to get them on the show, too. Right. But to at least have that, or to see that, it's number one, encouraging that it can exist. Mm-hmm. And even though that may not be everyone's story, it still is something that's really amazing as an example of what a happy family unit looks like in mm-hmm. a sense. So the fact that you all have that with one another as a relationship, that's something definitely not to take for granted. You all clearly are your biggest supporters and advocates, whether it is with your own branded with your own branded activities or aspirations, or how you all personally treat each other. So I am super happy to have had you on the show. This conversation was amazing.
Yeah, thank you for inviting
us. I was sleepy at first, and now y'all got me all energized to finish cleaning the rest of my house because I do laundry and shit. Mm. But yes, I was so happy to have you all on
the
show.
Yeah, this was great. This was cool. This was fun. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. So just wrapping up with my motivational message going into the week, this really has been, I guess I was in my own like little mental space. Do we really understand the difference between like a bond and a relationship? And I think sometimes we allow treatment of ourselves, or I should say we allow others to treat us less than, and we chalk it up to, oh, well, you know, that's the bond, or this is, you know, I've been around this person, or I owe this person life, or whatever the, you know, the relationship might be. There is a respect found in a bond. There's, I feel, divine reasons why there are bonds, you know, that you have with one another, or who is allowed to enter in your life, or the way that they've entered into your life. But the difference between a bond and a relationship, in my humble opinion, a relationship just is something that is continuous effort. It's something that you have to evolve with and continuously pour into. It's something that you can't just be entitled and take for granted that if, you know, if this is how we started in 1999, I don't have to necessarily be consistent or whatever, but this is how we're going to be in 2019. That is nothing further than the truth. So when it comes down to not only personally examining what we tolerate, whether it's in business, whether it's in our personal life, I don't care if it's, you know, family, friend bonds. Oh, this is my oldest friend, or this is just how they are. This person always got you in some bullshit. Examine what you tolerate. You know, that might be a bond, but the relationship isn't one of positivity. It's not one of health. It's continuously stopping your own progression. Why entertain it? And it doesn't mean that you have to separate or let go from it in like a super, you know, loving hip hop over the top, throwing drinks and fighting type of way. But there's nothing wrong with loving somebody from a distance. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. I can love you and still be like, I'm not going to deal with your shenanigans, or I have to keep you at bay because I need to protect my peace and my own happiness. 2019, as far as I'm concerned, is here. There's, because let's be honest, we got one more good week to work than everybody going on work from home status if they looking at emails at all. Let's just keep it real. So, and thinking about, you know, certain relationships, not even in terms of like, oh, the new year's coming, but truly examine what you tolerate, examine who is in your life, examine yourself, because maybe you aren't even the victim. Maybe you are the one that is taking your relationship for granted, being entitled, not being the best person that you can be to yourself there, and there in turn, not being as good of a person, a daughter, a son, a father, a sister, a cousin, a friend, a lover, whatever, to those in your life, or whatever that relationship, quote unquote, is that you have. So I think that's something that everyone really needs to, you know, just do some self-examination, myself included. Where have I, do a SWOT analysis of yourself. I don't care. What are your strengths? What are your weaknesses? What are your opportunities or areas for growth? What threatens that? And if you are looking at that in real, you know, and taking into account, or having, I should say, accountability, you will have a revelation in a sense, or at least if not a revelation, you'll have the foundation to better yourself, which is all that anyone can ask of you. You know, it's not about perfection. It is about just bettering yourself. So don't get caught up on bonds. You know, bonds get you out of jail, too. So I'm like, or put you there. So I'm like, that's not necessarily all the times a good thing. Hope everyone has an amazing week, except Michael Cohen and Manafort with that raggedy dry ass toupee and 45. It's coming, sis. It's coming. Like, everybody is sitting there with a Dougie, like, woo, let me Millie Rock the hell up out this office, because you ain't about to have me in the same jail with the Wolf of Wall Street. No, no. But yes, everyone have a great week. I'm just sitting back here looking at American politics with the butter and popcorn going, woo, child of ghetto. So, I will holler at you all next week. Bye.